terrifying elevation to be at.
Is it okay then? I'll just give a very brief introduction then.
Righto, yes. Sure.
Well, I don't think I need to, but nevertheless it's an immense pleasure to, as it were, reintroduce Dr. Behan to everybody who does know him so well, and to say how absolutely delighted we are that he's coming again this year to give us three, as it were, seminar groups. They've been billed as lectures, but really they are seminar groups, because he would welcome people asking questions and making contributions. And we hope that in the course of the 3 days, you know, many questions and points will occur to people which they may have an opportunity to bring up when they wish. I want to warn everybody that we're being recorded by the BBC, and if any of you do say anything that you feel might be injudicious, or that you might like to recall, or that you might not be willing to be have quoted, either accurately or inaccurately, do please write in and say, because in any future program that is made of this, you would have, as it were, the right to delete or to be obsolete, as the case may be. So you have been warned. Maybe if you write into me at the Tavistock, if you feel that you would like your contribution rescinded. Of course, you may not be used at all. That's all. And there are leaflets, I think, perhaps enough for people to share, if not to have individually. So from now on, we leave it to Dr. Behan and everybody.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction. It's somewhat frightening, because one feels that after that it's a little difficult to know what to say. The point is that I find it extremely dull having questions answered which I haven't asked. And for that reason, I think it would be preferable if I give you a sort of rough idea of what I propose to say. I'll try to keep it pretty short. And then, if you will ask any questions you care to ask. I don't say that I shall answer them, but I can usually find a few more questions to ask you, and so it goes on. Which I think is a natural kind of development, because one usually finds that most questions cause a whole lot more questions to occur. One never seems to get to a point of an answer unless you look back on it. You think, well, one has apparently gathered some kind of experience in the meantime. Well, I feel rather disposed to consider this kind of work from the point of view of the analyst. I mean that by that the person who is theoretically responsible for the conversation. I'm thinking of Freud's quotations, which he was constantly referring to, of Charcot, and Charcot's insistence on observation. Well, that seems to me to be absolutely the essence of it, observation. The only trouble is observing what? One starts off with something which is really difficult, because I don't think that the language even is adequate for the sort of job that we have to do. What are we observing? We have to use the word an observation anyway as a kind of metaphor. It's an approximation. I think I've got the quotation from Paradise Lost, in which Milton talks of the situation in which he has cannot fall back on this, on his eyes because he's blind, and he says that he hopes that he'll be able to see and tell of things invisible to mortal sight. Well, one can't hope for that, but somehow we do observe things which are very often not observed in the ordinary course of social intercourse. And I think it'd be rather useful if one could formulate in one's own mind what it is that one is observing. It's a question which crops up all the time that we're doing this kind of work at all. Therefore, it needs to be kept in constant repair. One has to reconsider all the while, what is this that one is observing? How would one formulate it if one was trying to convey it to somebody else? Into what form of words would you put it? Let's say, if you put it into words. It's curious that we do, in fact, resort to words about it. Probably partly because it's our most recent acquisition, the ability to talk an articulate language. But of course, the language itself, we're having to borrow words which have been used for quite other purposes and formulated for quite other purposes. For the kind of thing that we're wanting to use them for now, well, it simply wasn't over the horizon. So, the first point seems to me to get clear as one can what in one's own experience, never mind the books or what one's been told or anything of that sort, but in one's own experience, one is really observing. Now, if you also agree that what you're going to use yourself is verbal articulate communication, what words do you propose to use? Now, this is the other point, namely, to draw up your own vocabulary, your own individual vocabulary. Now, why I say this is because the words that we have to borrow are so devaluated. They're really like a coinage which is worn so thin that you can't read the superscription on the thing. You don't know what its denomination is. You don't know what its value is. So, to change the metaphor again, it's like a surgeon who has to do an operation, but he has also got to sharpen up his scalpels and so forth before and during the operation. If one can cut down one's vocabulary to a very minimum, then I think there's some chance of finding one's own way of using the words to which one is most accustomed. And there's also a chance that the analysands will gradually learn how you speak the language that you're speaking, whether it's English, French, Italian, or whatever. Because if you go on using the same words with accuracy, your accuracy, then the patient has a chance of understanding what things mean. Take words like sex, for example. It's simply ridiculous. It's borrowed from biology. And it is used as if it really meant something by us. Well, if we were simply dealing with the anatomy and physiology, I think it would be possible to use those words fairly correctly. When it comes to using them in what one considers is a mental sphere, that's assuming again that there is such a thing as a mind or a character or personality, then it becomes quite a problem as to where a person leaves off, as it were. What are his edges? Freud speaks about this impressive caesura of birth, and it is true. I find that people are tremendously impressed by that word, and curiously enough, also by the word death. Both of them of no importance whatsoever. They're inevitable, and there's really nothing to be said about them. But they're so impressive. You know, you get ridiculous things said like, will you come and look after these people in the in this particular ward, should we say, of a hospital. They're terminal cancer patients. Terminal cancer. You've only got to think about it a bit, and you realize what a ridiculous phrase it is. How do they know it's terminal? Terminal of what? What is the end point of? And in any case, what we are concerned with, we're not really concerned with arranging the funeral arrangements or something of that nature. What we're really concerned with is living people. And if there's a job to be done for making the life of people in a particular ward bearable for such length of time as they've got to live, then there's something to be done. That's got nothing to do with terminal cancer or terminal anything. It's got to do with making such life as is still to come, which is still left over, whatever's still in the bank, so to speak, tolerable and available. And finding some method by which the patient can be given a chance of getting onto that wavelength where you bother with what can be done and don't bother over much with what you can't do. I sometimes think, you know, that there's almost an occupational neurosis of analysts. because so much time is spent in finding out the various mistakes that are made, our faults, sins, crimes, and so forth, that one forgets that it's a very unimportant part of the whole story. Because one wants to know, no doubt, what one is bad at. It's quite useful to know that. But the really important thing to know is, what part of it are we any good at? So even if you've got somebody who is supposed to be in their terminal stages, the really important thing is, what are they still good for? What would you do with the geriatric patients? It's almost as silly at the other end of the scale. Of course, it's no good, they'll say, to analyze a child of 2 or 3 or 5. I've even heard fantastic statements talked about not being able to do anything when the fibers aren't myelinated. Well, the trouble with the myelinated fibers is that the persons who've got them are so often so rigid, so obstructed, that you can't get another idea through their myelin. On the other hand, if you've got a reasonably intelligent baby, and quite early in the proceedings, you put it in a potty, its non-myelinated bottom seems to know what to do. And it will then proceed to perform very adequately without any fuss or bother. Now, why that is, I don't know. But I think that the infant must have a personality, and so must the old person. However ill they may be, however convinced that they are that they've reached their terminal position. If they had, there's no problem. There is a problem, though, in that little tiny gap of whatever it is, day, weeks, months, between that point and the point at which one no longer exists. So I think once again, one has to get back to this curious business of considering that not only has one anatomy and a physiology, but also a mind. Canst thou not minister to a mind diseased? Remember the question which directed towards Lady Macbeth sleepwalking? The answer presumably would have to be something like, well, not at the moment, but in 400 years, come along again and I'll tell you what we can do. Similarly today, come along again in 400 years and we'll give an idea. But in the meantime, each one of us individually lives this very short period, this ephemeral existence, possibly in which one could use this hypothetical mind that I'm talking about to contribute something to the general fund. There does seem to be some kind of inheritance of ideas or character or personality. I don't think it's very much good falling back on the ordinary accepted rules of genetic inheritance. One has to reconsider whether these acquired characteristics are not in fact transmittable. And then comes to the point of how one is to transmit them. I don't really want to talk much longer about it, but as usual, I find it difficult to stop once I start. So I'll go a little bit further. I'd like to consider the patient that you're seeing tomorrow. I have a great advantage about this because I know nothing whatsoever about it. So I'm not so easily misled as you are, who probably think that you saw him or her today. But what I want to suggest is that that fact, while it has its advantages, is also a bit of a nuisance, because it stands in the way of the fact that the patient has gone on living and thinking, and they will not be the same patient tomorrow as they are today, or at the end of a session as they were at the beginning. That point is curiously difficult to grasp in the actual practice, and that's what I'm trying to talk about here. I'm not really very interested in the theories of psychoanalysis or psychiatry or any other theories, because I think that the really important thing is the real thing, what I call the real thing. The practice of analysis, the practice of treatment, the practice of communication. The question then arises is, how are you to speak to this patient, the one that you have never seen before, but are liable to think that you have, because you saw him today. Now, the difficulty is this point, namely, that when you're dealing with a mind or character, the boundaries are not so clearly marked as you are, as they appear to be, when you're dealing with their anatomy and physiology. To fall back again on established usage, one can talk about the past, infancy. In infancy, the patient felt such and such, they had this or that trauma, and it had this or the other effect. Well, that is very useful if you consider the patient as developing in a line, born, married, died, he yak it, finished. But the patient, when you see him or her tomorrow, is not like that. You don't see somebody who is born, married, and dies. It's very difficult indeed to see what goes on between the beginning of the session and the end of it. One reason for this is that the noise is so deafening. I mean by that the information which is constantly bombarded with through our auditory apparatus, and which one is also constantly bombarded with from, and here I have to say a question mark. I don't know from where. But the point is this, that the noise is so deafening, you know so much about your history, so much about the patient's history, so much about psychoanalysis, medicine, physiology, music, painting, and so on. It's very difficult indeed to be able to detect this thing which I think we are really observing, or what we're wanting to observe at any rate. And that's one reason why I think it is easier to talk about forgetting what you know and forgetting what you want, getting rid of your desires, anticipations, and also your memories, so that there will be a chance of hearing these very faint noises which are embedded in this mass of noise. I imagine that even a newborn infant has to do this. When a newborn infant opens its eyes and is suddenly presented with masses of facts by its ocular apparatus, by its optic apparatus, then there has to be some sort of selection. But this also applies to us from our angle. Now, Freud, speaking of his admiration of Charcot, also points out how important it is not to indulge your imagination, to stick to facts. Well, I entirely agree with that, and I'm constantly contradicting it. When I say to people in the supervision, look, when you're with a patient, you've got to be careful what you say. I'm sure you ought to give the correct interpretations. Not here. I would like you to give your imagination a bit of exercise. So, say anything, however silly, idiotic, stupid, unjustified it is. Then, after you've said it, then we'll get on to another point, which is what is the evidence and so forth. But in the meantime, let's cut out all that and concentrate on what you imagine. Speculative imagination. Speculative reasons. I know what the objection is to it, because it is said that you can imagine anything you like, and certainly reasons are so common that they just spring up like brambles. If one's hunting for the sleeping beauty of truth, the difficulty is to cut your way through all these brambles. But I've only got to say, give your imaginations rein to be reasonably sure that we'll be silent for the rest of the hour. Nobody dares to say it. Because everybody believes that there's a psychiatrist, myself or somebody, knocking around the place, waiting to tell them the correct interpretation or to do the correct thing, which probably includes shut them up in a mental hospital or bring them under restraint in some way or another. And the result is that their imaginations atrophy and they become what I would call sterile.